Specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Kelly! Yeah!
February 4, 2020, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this is the show. You know where you are, you know what it is, because you found it. But anyway, do appreciate you, especially if you're on the live stream, no matter if you're over there in Australia or you're somewhere in Colombia, which I do see you guys on the live stream tonight, or all across America, like the rest of our listeners, everywhere from, I don't know, Las Vegas to, I guess it's pronounced Kissimmee, Florida. Either way, greetings to you. It is Tuesday, Tears Day, the second day of the broadcast week. And, yeah, this is always a good one. Why? Because in the first hour, we have Mike Swanson with us, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. But, you know, if you think he's just a financial website guy, no, he's an author, too. The War State, the book I always recommend. He's working on some books about Vietnam. He's got a podcast out there, the Wall Street Window Podcast, which is really interesting. All the time, goes across historical stuff, financial stuff, current events, you name it. Great stuff. But anyway, second hour, JP Satilli, the news vandal himself, who released a couple of articles via Patreon earlier today. And, I wonder what we'll be talking to JP about. Think it'll have something to do with the debacle in Iowa, or maybe it'll have something to do with the Trumposphere and what's going to happen during the State of the Union and blah, 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 blah. Will it be all that, or will it be something else? I never know until JP shows up. There is no choreography here. Yeah, I just screwed that up. Good. I feel like I'm Trump now. Choreography that goes into the second hour or the first hour because it is unscripted. Anyway, let's get to it before I keep running my mouth for no apparent reason. Mike Swanson is with us. Mike, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
You know, I'm actually feeling okay. I know it doesn't sound it because, you know, I'm tripping over choreography as a word. But it is a day in which we have a lot to talk about for sure. What would we do on this show if there wasn't something to talk about? Oh, I know. I'd probably just spin records. But anyway. You know, it's an interesting time, Mike. You know, all kinds of political debates, different discussions about what's happening, why the Democrats are failing to even appear to be organized at all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a good time to look at something else because the backdrop always has this element in it lately of in the past couple of years, the economy's been good. Now, I argue on this show that it's not. I argue on this show, just like a lot of people, you know, who are having actual discussions on other parts of the aisles, I guess, where they're saying that, you know, really the average guy is not doing any better than he was a few years ago. We are being choked, actually, by wage stagnation and a lack of it being able to keep up with a very sort of unnoted inflation and all that. And you know what I keep hearing? Well, the market's doing well. You know, the prices of things actually aren't so bad, but they're going up where I live. I don't know. I hear it all over the country. Seems like everybody's getting charged more. And by the way, check your electric bills and your internet providers because I don't think any of them didn't jack us up at the beginning of 2020 here. So, hooray. Things cost more, Mike. And, well, the market's doing well is the answer. And meanwhile, I don't have any money in the market. I don't. What is going on, Mike Swanson?
Well, a lot of ways things look the way they do depending on where you're living and so forth. So, for example, if you live in Seattle and you work in an Amazon warehouse and you can't afford rent because the prices in Seattle are insane. My dad was born in Tacoma, Washington, and I went out there a couple of times when my grandparents were still alive, and he went to college in Seattle, at a medical college, university, and he's, you know, passed away almost over 20 years ago now. But a few months ago, I was looking through some of his stuff with my mom, and I found something from when he was in college, and it had his address on it. So I went and looked it up, and this was in Seattle, and he what came up, you know, on my internet search was a small house about 500 square feet that was in a port area, you know, right on the edge of water in a, like a, you know, like a port.
Right.
And this university he went to looked like it was a mile or two walking distance, or not very far, maybe a little far than a mile or two, but you know, it was a walking distance, like across a bridge or something.
Okay.
And the house or place he was living in, basically a boathouse, was for rent, and it had a price to buy it that was in the millions of dollars.
Right.
Millions. And when he lived there, you can just, I can just, you know, I could just imagine this was probably a dump neighborhood or something. I mean, it looked like, you know, an industrial area or something. And I'm just trying to say that you talk about inflation. The biggest inflation is in housing. I mean, this is a place worth a million or whatever now, some crazy amount of money.
Right.
And it was probably worth nothing, in a dump when, you know, in the late 60s.
Right. And that has a ripple effect. That is one of the biggest killers, actually, is the housing costs for people.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a ripple effect because if you live somewhere trendy or you live near somewhere trendy, guess what you get? I looked at rents in Jersey not too long ago. Now, Jersey's not exactly trendy, but the fact is that it has a very close proximity to not only New York City but Philadelphia. And because of that, you know, it's a very short drive across that state, in fact, right? So it's interesting. You have beachfront property, which obviously is more expensive to begin with. But then I looked at just sort of middle of the road places and even ones that haven't been gentrified, which, Asbury Park is now a gentrified area. It was a rough neighborhood when I lived there. Now there's like wine stores there. Okay. anyway, it's interesting to me that the average rent in most of the areas where if I could, you know, move back tomorrow where I would go, not exactly the trendy areas, not exactly, you know, the greatest of neighborhoods even. All of those rents have doubled in the past 15 years. Doubled. And that's saying a lot because, you know, an $800 rent is almost unheard of in a lot of places in different southern states where I've lived. It's like, how could you even pay that much to live somewhere, you know, unless it's a really nice place? And it's like, no, a dump is what you paid $800 for where I lived. And now, you know, you're looking at $13, $15, $1,600 monthly.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. So what, and what's, I mean, I haven't been there to see it, but supposedly what's going on in Seattle or that area is the people working in the Amazon warehouses can't afford the rent. So some of them basically live in tents. Mm-hmm. And supposedly this sort of thing is going on in San Francisco, although I would assume, you know, JP could answer that better than I can. All that said, though, the contrast is this little news item I'm staring at that says that Jeff Bezos, who, you know, founded Amazon, owns the Washington Post, one of the real elites of our country, he sold some stock last week that he owns in Amazon, and he sold $1.8 billion worth. You know, so that's that's the contrast. You know, but you talk about, so yeah, if you own a lot of stocks and you can sell them, you can make a lot of money. But we're in a moment now in the markets that's really almost breathtaking. Because I been doing this stock market stuff now for over 20 years now, and I saw the internet bubble and participated in it in a certain sense, trading internet stocks, and so I can remember what some of them did, even though it's now 20 years since that bubble burst. But Tesla is going up so much, it's crazy. So Tesla,
that is a weird thing too. I'm like, wait, pause for a second, because Tesla is a weird thing to watch.
This might be one for the history books when it's over.
Okay.
Tesla, I'm just giving you the share prices. Tesla was $200 in June, and over the past couple years, and I've been one of these people, have made the argument that Tesla doesn't really make money. They make debt, and they're growing their debts all the time and probably will go bankrupt. And in fact, I saw Ralph Nader make a tweet saying basically that Tesla is a scam,
which is kind of funny.
Ralph Nader tweeting about Tesla, but it doesn't matter. What has happened is that there are people that have been very vocal critics of the company who bet against the stock, try to short the stock.
Right.
And when you short the stock, you're betting against it. You borrow shares from the broker and sell them. And then you got to close that position out to either take a profit or take a loss by buying shares from the stock market to close your position. Well, Tesla has been one of the most, if not the most shorted stock in history in the terms of the amount of money that people have been using to bet against the stock.
Right. Now, let me add something in here. And there's a reason for that, though, Mike, because on a very real world level, Tesla's had difficulties delivering their products on time, actually delivering to paying clients their cars in complete form. They've had trouble delivering on other promises they made about, well, don't worry, you're going to get this upgraded thing very soon. You'll just come into the dealership and get it done, you know, whatever. Meanwhile, I don't think there are any Tesla dealerships, or if there are, there aren't that many. You know, you have this really crazy character of Elon Musk, who is at the center of all this. He got himself in a little trouble not too long ago.
SEC, but before, one of the things he did, he had a company called Solar City, okay, and it was trading on the stock market, and they make solar panels, and they were having trouble with their solar panels, people complaining about them, and it was the same sort of thing. The thing wasn't turning a profit, it was accumulating massive debts, and it was in danger of going bankrupt. And instead of having that happen, Musk had Tesla buy Solar City. So he's the CEO of both companies. That's nice. Just, you know, really strange stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what's interesting, though, now is the stock was $200 in June, and it went up to $350 in November. And then it went to 400 around January the 1st. As we're speaking, it closed today right below 900.
900 a share?
900. This stock has gone from 200 to 900. It's gone from 550 to over 900 today. It was 550 a week ago. Now it's 900. Yeah, Yesterday, an analyst came out with a report before the market opened, and the stock, when he put this report out, was at 650. It closed 650 Friday. So he put out a report with a prediction that the stock would go to 15,000. It was 650. He said it would go to 15,000. Well, If the stock went to 15,000, okay, you would have a market cap. It would be the biggest valued company in the entire world and in the entire history of the world.
Right?
Ever. So the way you calculate market cap is the price times the number of shares outstanding. The company that's got the largest market cap, the biggest company in the world, is Microsoft.
Okay.
It's $987 billion. And if Tesla went to 15,000, Tesla would be worth over twice what Microsoft is worth now.
Yeah, that's like impossible. I mean,
and Tesla already
for Tesla to do that.
Is worth it's already crazy because Tesla is worth more than Ford and GM combined. And now you're saying it's going to be worth more twice as much as Microsoft.
That's insane. I don't know if you're looking at our chat room right now, Mike, but there is some interesting information going on in there.
Okay.
One of the people in the chat room might be JP Satilli. I'm not sure. But interesting information here is going on in the chat room where they're talking about, Tesla gaming, carbon credits or something or pollution credits in order to, show profitability. I mean, there's a couple of things there I'd like you to read over because again, this whole Tesla thing is so bizarre. And just, I don't know, smells to me, here I go again with my gut, right? Seems to me like a giant kind of con situation. Because again, you can't deliver on your products, you can't deliver on your cars, they haven't delivered on the amount of cars they said they were going to make. They have failed actually as a car manufacturer, and as they stand, they're valued higher than manufacturers who have actually successfully produced what it is they claimed they would produce. It's such a weird kind of like, don't worry, it's coming, you know, kind of situation. And Musk, again, with the SEC thing and, you know, watch out, he'll buy up a company and because, you know, there might be a problem with that company. I mean, it's sort of like what Google did where they started buying up everybody, which is another argument was made in the chat room. But believe me, I thought of it. Where, you know, just, okay, they just buy them as soon as they start to compete or complain or do something else. You know, it's just one of these continuously cannibalizing sort of capitalist situations.
I see the statement he's making about, and I don't know, I mean, this is a, it's probably what he's doing. what he's saying here is, for people who can't see the chat room, Tesla is gaining pollution credits to make it look on the books like it achieved profitability. So, and he quotes something that says Tesla's revenues were up 2%, but net income plunged 25%. Without regulatory credits, it would have lost $28 million. Mm-hmm. So here's it's even probably worse than regulatory credits. So the way that might sound at first, because one thing he did in the past is that he had a bunch of quarters where he was losing money and saying I'm losing money. And then he would keep predicting, well, we're going to turn a profit. And like I said, there's legions of Tesla critics that know a lot more about it than I do. And they were arguing it's impossible. They had people even going out to his factories and taking pictures of it, like spying on it. And, and he had like people leaking out information. He said we're spies and all this stuff. And then magically he did report a profit, but the way he did it is by saying, accounts receivable. He said we got accounts receivable for the next 12 months of, you know, so many hundreds of millions of dollars. Right. And then he used that to say he's got a profit. In other words, he was claiming we've got all these future sales booked but we're going to claim them now, even though they're not collecting a penny of it.
Well, and so also remember what I just said.
He could be doing that regulatory credits too. Like maybe these credits are going to be paid out, you know, over 12 months or 5 years. He's claiming them all now or something. Could easily. Yeah, it's just the accounting gimmicks.
It's a bunch of them because, again, like I said before, they failed to deliver on a whole bunch of product. You know, I mean, just real world business basics, right? You have to make your product before you can sell it. They failed to deliver on product they owed people that was already accounted for as far as their accounts receivable. And now they have more accounts receivable. You know, will they even come close to, you know, meeting the threshold there and actually selling what it is they claim they've already pre-sold? Who knows? He's basically saying, I've got these bills where it's already booked. You know, I've got pledges of $1 billion.
Yeah, basically. But the reason, you know, I don't really care about him, you know, as a character or whatever. It to me, this is a metaphor of, yes, of the economy and the stock market, everything. Because this stock went up 18%. Yeah, 19% yesterday. It's up 19% today. It's crazy. And I know, I'm sure, certain that a lot of the move up over the past 90 days, in particular this week, is fueled by people being forced to close out their short positions or they'll, you know, because let me put it this way. If you buy, say you buy a stock for $10 and it falls to $5, you lose half your money that you put in. But if you short a stock for $200 and it goes up to 800, you lose 4 times your money. You the losses when you short a stock can be exponential. So, and when something is going straight up, it's going straight up the way Bitcoin did, 2 years ago. That's what what happens is you can't predict the moment it's going to top out. It's disconnected from reality of the fundamentals.
Right.
It could have said that 6 months ago, but it now, you know, is for sure. And it could top out tomorrow. It could top out next week. It's just completely unpredictable. But in 1999, there were several stocks, internet stocks, that they would go up like this. And they would have analysts that would come out and just make insane price predictions based on nothing.
Right.
And this reminds me so much of that. And the crazy thing is, I got a list of stocks that have giant short positions, and the idea that, well, if Tesla's going up like this, they, same thing could happen to them too. Another one that I've mentioned on the show or ranted about on Facebook is Chipotle, which is another company that's had problems over the years, but they've got a giant short position. So
Chipotle restaurants, those places?
Yeah.
Mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you about the parallel with another company that I know you have looked at
What's that?
The past, it's Netflix, because Netflix for a long time was, you know, running.
No, it's
pretty...
one too. It's got a giant short position also.
Yeah.
And what happens is when these shorts get giant, I mean, when these stocks get giant short positions, generally speaking, the reasons for the people doing this tend to come true. Maybe not immediately, but the people that short sell stocks are more sophisticated than people who just don't do that, just buy whatever. They tend to, you know, be looking at balance sheets and not just price action solely. And Netflix also is a company that has billions of dollars in debt, doesn't turn a profit.
Right.
But
still maintains a high value.
Yeah, and they have a giant short position, but not as big as Tesla. But in terms of the dollar value of the short position, it's very large for Netflix. What makes Tesla unique is, I mentioned the idea of a market cap. That's the price times the number of shares outstanding. The percentage of the shares that are shorted of Tesla are around 20%, which is an extremely high number, which is probably the reason it's – one of the reasons it's shooting up like this. But it's just crazy. You know, and to me, this is a metaphor for the whole market, because it's been rallying since October, and
for no reason. You know,
The Fed lowered rates three times last year, and they started a new quantitative easing thing where they continually are injecting billions of dollars into the stock market every single week. And ever since they started doing that, it's been going up. And people in the market see that, hear that news, and come away with the conviction that at the moment the Federal Reserve is never going to let the stock market drop again, at least in the foreseeable future. And if it does drop, they're going to print more money. So why should I sell? Why should I not buy Netflix or Tesla or Netflix or any of these stocks?
Oh, wow.
So that's where we're at. That's why it's very similar, I think, to the end of 1999 when all that was, you know, running like crazy.
Well, is this like the Fed bubble? I mean, that was the tech bubble, you know. Is this like the Fed bubble that has, you know, an endless supply of capital because they have the printing press? I mean, is that what it basically boils down to?
I think that's – I don't – no one's given a name for it, but that sounds just as good as any.
Yeah, I mean, but that sounds reasonable to describe what it is you're talking about here. I mean, if I understand you, I may be misunderstanding this.
No, no, it's basically exactly what I'm saying. And I still think, you know, I don't see signs the stock market's going to top, but it could easily dip 5% at any moment, you know, or 10% from the high. And it's really, the moment's real fascinating because we talked last week about this coronavirus in Asia.
Yeah, right.
And that's brought a lot of negative news, let's say, on television, worries about the global economy. And all it did was make the stock market fall 2 or 3 days from its most recent high. And now it's bounced back up. It doesn't mean it can't retest the low or go through it, but it doesn't mean anything if it does.
Well, and still, by the way, for the record, I'm still on the side of not being very nervous about this because it's just not that big a deal. But what's fascinating to me is that Wilbur Ross made a weird statement this week regarding this. I don't know if you caught it. But
yeah, he's always saying it's going to be good for us or something.
Yeah, it's going to be good for us because it's going to discourage people from taking Chinese import. Basically what he said is, people are going to be more afraid to take Chinese imports now, so it's going to help the U.S. And I'm like, what a weird thing to say about something that's, you know, killed a couple hundred people. More people have died, by the way, during this flu season as it stands from the flu than they have from the coronavirus worldwide, just so you know. But, and I mean exponentially more, like five times more, three times more at least, than what has actually perished, you know, according to the numbers. And we've got, you know, 6 or 8 or, I don't know, 10 cases now in the U.S., whatever. It's not, you know, the pandemic everybody keeps giving it the energy that it seems to be. But it's certainly something. But I found it weird that Wilbur Ross would, like, pipe up and say that during this time period. And what did you think of that when that came up as far as trade goes and, you know, the idea that, okay, we have the MCA now. Stage one of the Chinese, you know, compromise over there with Trump is happening. I don't know what that all means. Oh, wait a minute. That means he's going to slap less tariffs on them. He's still putting tariffs on wine and cheese from France, right? I don't know. I can't keep track of it because, you know, impeachment palooza got in the way. And also we have this thing in Iowa now. But, you know, here we go. This is a weird game that's getting played financially right now, Mike. And I see it as, you know, entirely manipulated. None of this is organic. Not the market. Not our economy as it allegedly stands. Not our economy as it really stands. And the fact is that, you know, there is definitely a split level here. You know, some people are playing with this stocks and shorting and whatever. And then there's the rest of us who are, you know, quietly getting, you know, kind of like a boa constrictor squeezes on you in order to suffocate you as far as the economy goes, nobody tends to notice all that badly, even though the snake is wrapped around you, because incrementally as you exhale, that's when he squeezes. And that's the way the economy has felt to me for many years. Of course, it's a much slower process than the boa constrictor would have on us all. But either way, this is what's going on. And to me, it's like a big game. And it makes it even more ridiculous that anybody would connect, and I'm sorry to say this, but anybody would connect Wall Street in any way to the day-to-day economy for, I don't know, 90% of the public.
Well, it's quite remarkable because here's an interesting thing I heard.
Sure.
Well, I'll say this in a minute because it might be relevant to the elections and stuff, but let me say this first. The remarkable thing is, when Trump won, you knew basically he was going to lower taxes in some way and increase defense spending. I mean, you right. knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, that was like a guarantee. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and he did that. You know, he right. cut corporate taxes. They've increased government spending to the point, you know, we got the defense budget's over $800 billion now. But when he presented these ideas right after the election that he won, the economists in his administration were predicting that this would create 3.5% GDP growth. Which we hadn't seen since 2008. In 2014, the economy got to over 2.8%, right. and it got to that again in 2017. But it was less than 2%, 1, 2, four out of 10 of the last 10 years.
Right.
And it seemed like a reasonable assumption that the corporate tax cuts and increased spending, that's a lot of stimulus, would generate 3.5% GDP growth, or 3% even.
But it hasn't, has it?
No. In fact, we haven't – it's not even higher – it was higher when Obama was president a couple years than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
It was – 2.5% in 2018 and only 2.3% last year. We found that out last week. The government released last year's GDP estimate. So
right.
we're
they reevaluated certain things, because remember it was a much rosier
picture.
They do
that too. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
So that's right, because what happens is each quarter they'll put out their estimate for what happened that quarter,
right.
and then when the year's over, they'll go back and revise it. So they revised even their better estimates down.
Right.
So the point of this is we got a $1 trillion budget deficit.
Right.
And the economy's barely even growing.
Yeah,
so
even with the massive, basically stimulus by tax cut and by spending on military hardware and stuff like this, and of course, you know, none of the perpetual wars have actually ended or anything like that. So, you know, all those industries continue to profit. Doesn't seem to me as though any of the, other things that could be happening. I mean, they are cutting back on food stamps, you know, I mean, they're cutting some spending there. But it's not really stopping this rolling train that's going down the track of, you know, how many trillions can we throw away? I don't know what to say anymore. It's like none of it actually makes
any
sense to me.
Last year, with all those corporate tax cuts and the stock buybacks, the earnings for the S&P 500, the 500 biggest companies in the U.S. on the stock exchange, only grew 3.5%.
Yeah, what a shock. A tax cut for the rich didn't actually improve the economy in a realistic way. What a shocker.
Well, it's not just that it didn't improve the earnings for companies.
No, well, because they were buying back their own. Well, you and I talked about this a bunch of times, where they're buying back their own stock. They're not investing in new factories or expansion of their businesses, you know, that you actually have to lay out some money to get them going. They just were investing back into the company by buying their own stocks. So, you know, that is not real world. Again, that's not real world economy.
But that's why, I mean, I'm going back. The reason I'm thinking about the Musk and Tesla is the stock market. Tesla is completely disconnected. You know, the price action in Tesla means nothing about how many cars it's going to sell this year. It's just, you know, a short squeeze and people trading it. Because it's going up, and it has nothing to do with anything but that, and that's symptomatic of everything in the stock, everything about the stock market. It's not really about earnings or the valuations. It's just pure speculation based on the movement of the prices.
Yeah, it's just gaming.
That's why it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it's a game, and it's got zero to do with not only the economy, but the business that you're actually investing in. See, that's the thing. It's a whole separate deal, sort of like that website, which, by the way, I can't sign up to because they don't believe I am who I am. My identity, for some reason, is in question over there. But that betting website, I mean, it's pretty much like that. It's at that point where it's not actually connected to anything, except you are cashing in on real things. You know what I mean? It's really weird, Mike. It's really weird that this is the way the stock market functions, which I remember when it was first explained to me when I was a kid, that that's not how it ran. But does seem to be the way it is now. If you can come up with a good enough game, doesn't matter if your company produces anything. See, that was the interesting thing about the tech bubble there, which, by the way, Amazon survived through. You know, unlike many other companies that, you know, absolutely vanished off the planet. But if you remember, a lot of that stuff was like just based on speculation about things that they hadn't even done yet. I mean, that's basically it was. And, you know, so eventually you end up with, you know, literally penny stocks instead of the stuff that was trading at, you know, if you consider a penny versus a $10 bill, it's pretty significant. You know, percentage-wise, and that's how that bubble was created, a whole bunch of speculation over nothing. And here you go now, you got, you know, there is something happening, but it's not coming anywhere near something that should be trading at that level, and yet it is. I don't know, you know, what can I do but tip my hat to the people who can make money doing this? I just, you know, if you can make a living and not actually, you know, follow through and fulfill your obligations, I mean, more power to you. But that's the way I view Musk, because all I saw for the past 2 years is pretty much them failing to do anything in a real world sense that they kept promising to do. And no matter what, yeah, the price keeps going up. And that's kind of scary to go up from 200 to 700 in a couple of months off of virtually nothing. I don't know. It's a weird circumstance, Mike.
When something does that, it tops out and collapses at some point. That's what happened with Bitcoin 2 years ago. But something interesting I saw the other day was a survey of people and their perceptions on the economy. And it said that people are actually optimistic on the moment, on now with the economy, but extremely pessimistic over and after the next 12 months. Like they say, what do you think about 12 months from now? And they're extremely pessimistic, although they're optimistic about this moment. When you ask them, when you say now, they're optimistic. When you say, well, what about 12 months later? They're extremely pessimistic. And historically, in these type of surveys, what ends up happening is at some point the short-term optimism merges with the pessimism. So it's like people are thinking a recession's coming, but it's okay right now. Things are great.
But 2 years ago, you know, again, when Trump was first, you know, doing his thing, I guess people were more optimistic and optimistic about the future. Maybe they're getting an idea that things are about to change, and now we're at that pivot point where as soon as they, you know, lose their faith in the system, so to speak, you know, and that's another weird thing, is that I don't even know why it is they have an optimism about the way things are now. I've said it, but, you know, the idea that there's a bit of pessimism about the future, I think about a year ago, that wasn't there, was it?
No, I don't think so. Mm. I think it started last summer.
Well, if everything's going so great, you know, and it's bigly, just like, you know, somebody said something about, well, Lord Orange said everything's great and it's big and it's huge. Yeah, it's huge, I guess, for somebody. But, you know, what is actually happening and what people think is going to happen? Again, this is, should not be the relevant thing that drives the economy, but somehow, I don't know, it seems to actually play a role in it, too. It's weird. And I guess it was always that way, but I don't know. Are people just more accustomed to the dips in the economy and they just wait for those now? I don't know. To me, it's like status quo, really. It just has not changed in a long time. It's been a certain way for a couple of decades, and it just seems to be stuck in that gear. And, yeah, I don't know why the stock market keeps going the way it does, because, again, the real world is not commensurate with the action in the stock market. But, you know, here we are. It is what it is. And Elon Musk is a weird figure. I've even done shows with the guy Artisan Loaf. I don't know if you'd listen to those, where he follows a lot of the stuff. I should probably have him back on, considering what's going on with Tesla and all this. I don't know. I don't know, Mike. I'm rather confused. As much as I feel like I understood this stuff before, I am once again at a loss for understanding why things are the way they are, how anybody can think that this is optimistic even in the next 6 months. Why it is that anybody thinks things are going well as it is, because they don't seem to have changed. I don't know. Is it just me?
Oh, I don't. No, it's just an acceleration of what's been happening already. It's just
okay. No,
nothing new, you know. But I don't know. It's hard to say, like, people's perceptions on the economy. How does that influence the election? It seems like the people that like Trump just think things are great and everyone else doesn't. That's kind of my assumption.
Is that what it is? Because, I mean, I keep noting, and that's another odd thing, is, you know, he thinks that every media outlet is the enemy except Fox News, I know, but all of these media outlets keep going, well, the economy is strong, the economy is strong, and I keep wondering where they live. Because, you know, again, it's just the economy is strong. And that's something, a plus for him. And it's like, really? Is it? I don't know. You know, it doesn't seem like it is. I see inflation coming in. I know that, you know, $3 heads of lettuce are pretty disgusting. They taste terrible. I don't know where they're getting them from. The last package I got said it was grown in the U.S. A lot of farmers are not doing so well. I imagine that's going to hurt us a bit in the long run. You know, I think there's a lot of damage been done here, but people still sit there with a smile and say, no, it's going great. And I don't get it. I just don't get it. I didn't get it before either when they were talking about the economic recovery under Obama. I didn't feel like there was much of a recovery. It was very, very slow moving, you know, where they said, oh, we're doing well in this recovery. And I kept going, not really. It took the better part of 4 years to really get out of that dip we were in, to get out of the hole, the way I see it. But again, my perception apparently.
Well, one thing that seems to be clear today is, I mean, Trump's the president, but if you were hoping that Biden was going to be able to stop him and save the whole country.
Yeah, well,
we're shit out of luck.
Mike, really? You know, if you want to go there, let's go there. Iowa, right? I got to tell you, it's so funny that they finally, after almost 24 hours, decided to release, you know, some of the stuff. I don't know. Maybe they released it all. I had to stop watching. I couldn't take it anymore.
Well, one thing's clear. By delaying the release, I don't even know if they got the final results out yet, but it's definitely helped boost Mayor Buttigieg.
Yeah, but you know, there you go. Here's the thing. I think I was going to save this for the next hour, but let's hit it.
Well, just transitioning. We got 15 minutes.
Yeah, I got you. Because I know I'm going to have to talk about this with JP, but let me give you the spoiler on my theory. I feel like that this was a self-inflicted, purposefully done thing in Iowa, actually.
Which and Buttigieg, I mean, it's easy to draw that scenario out. That's
yeah,
for sure.
And I'll tell you why. Because Buttigieg coming up on top is irrelevant in Iowa. And why? Because I don't feel as though, considering a significant portion of the country is not, regardless of what the Democrats think, is not going to accept an openly gay president. That's not going to happen. So allowing him to come out on top in Iowa is not a big deal. But if he had that momentum going into New Hampshire and it was confirmed, then, you know, that might have actually driven up interest in him. So I think they did this to protect the poor showing that Biden was having there, because I watched some of that stuff in real time, some of these video feeds coming out of Iowa, and there was nobody in some of those places that wanted to stand with Biden. Nobody.
Yeah, it's sad.
I mean, real bad. I mean, I'm surprised Andrew Yang got, you know, only 1%. I'm also surprised Amy Klobuchar exists, because I find her to be just an unattractive candidate altogether. She doesn't perform well. She doesn't have enough to say. I mean, she's optimistic and she smiles. But other than that, I mean, she's got nothing. And I don't know why she's even, you know, gathering more than 10%, but apparently she is. And I think that they basically wanted to ensure that Biden was not too terribly hindered by Iowa. And once again, I'm sorry to act. Here's a crazy thing. You ready, Mike? I'm going to agree with some of Trump's people. I think they're kneecapping Bernie Sanders right away because they want to make sure that he doesn't wind up being the apparent victor in this process early on, because if he is, they know they got an automatic loser on the ticket. And some of these people feel as though Biden is the only reasonable opponent for Trump. They're wrong, and quite frankly, all of it leads in the end to nothing more than an assured victory for Trump in November, because Biden can't compete with him. Sanders is going to be painted as way too radical. He's got young people interested in what he has to say. Buttigieg is not going to be acceptable across the board. Klobuchar can't be she just doesn't have it. It's just that simple. Warren is another one who's going to just kind of peter out, if you will. You're not going to see her doing anything. This is what I'm looking at. And meanwhile, they screwed this up. Maybe they need to call the NFL because, you know, those people know how to run a draft. And paring down, you know, the people that are in the pool and turning around and figuring out who is your best choice and who's your second choice and all this. This could have been done, should have been done, was easily done before. They got a failed app that came out. I mean, this is a mess.
I don't think Biden is going to get the Democrat nomination.
No, but that's what they want right now. I think that's what the DNC wants. So if they kneecap Iowa, then New Hampshire is a different
circumstance. Well, the thing about – okay, let's assume Buttigieg gets Iowa. Sanders is ahead in New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And then Biden gets South Carolina. It's just kind of a split, no matter who gets Nevada. And then you've got Super Tuesday, which is a whole bunch of, like, over 10 states at once,
right,
including California. So, in other words, the whole thing will be open but for California. But the problem with Biden is, well, you mentioned one of them, he's not drawing big crowds, but he also doesn't have a lot of money compared to the other candidates. He doesn't have the big campaign chest. So
see, but here's the other thing:
how's he going to compete on Super Tuesday?
Yeah, by attrition. Because here's the thing: even if he doesn't have too much money by Super Tuesday, some of these other candidates are going to fail because they're going to run out of money too. They're not going to be able to compete beyond those first three states unless they catch fire. See, that's the thing. And when you go to
Super Bowl. Maybe Bloomberg thinks he's going to win.
Well, Bloomberg's interesting because he can sit back and buy in.
Yeah, that's what he's doing.
But does anybody take him seriously? See, I didn't see him showing up on the caucuses either. In those live feeds, I got to tell you, Buttigieg looked like he was in third place. And you know, from what I saw, it looked like Sanders had, you know, at least some of those places locked down. Now, I know that I was looking at the eastern part of the state where there's, you know, a younger demographic and all that. So, therefore, you know, it's a little bit askew. But the fact is, I didn't see people enthusiastically embracing Biden.
I didn't know this, I've turned on MSNBC to see the results.
Right.
Before coming on here. And they were saying they had three different results. The first was the first round of voting.
Right.
And then the second round of voting, and Sanders won both. And then they had a third result, which they called delegates.
Right.
And they basically were explaining that these precincts are essentially gerrymandered, so some of the ones count more than others. Right. And that way, even if Sanders got more votes from individuals, since Buttigieg's in the more important precincts, he was able to get more delegates.
Yeah, right.
And that's how they're saying he's won.
Right, but that's the interesting thing. Like I said, in the first round, they turn around and try and get you to support whoever you're going to support. And then, you know, they eliminate everybody else. Look, you got to go somewhere else and support somebody else because your candidate is not viable percentage-wise. And a bunch of people, by the way, immediately walked out as soon as they couldn't get their, you know, their lower-level people. They walked out, so they had to readjust it. This is what they were blaming on the confusion earlier, and then they shut all that down and stopped making comments about what went wrong. But what I see is, again, I hate to agree with the Trump people, but I think basically the DNC, no matter what state it's in, no matter what the process is, they're going to do everything they can to kneecap Sanders. They don't want him to win the nomination. You know, it's just that simple. I think they've already chosen that Biden is the, you know, establishment pick. Buttigieg will make an interesting showing. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to look like, you know, I think Biden is going to win by attrition. I think he's going to get, you know, injections of money from the, you know, like you said, if he picks up South Carolina, it'll be just enough and to run out these other candidates who are actually working off of, you know, just their own
Do you have any idea what the turnout was in Iowa? Was it big or small? I've seen conflicting stories.
It's impossible to know because the fact
is we don't have the final results.
Yeah, well, and the thing is they also had these satellites where they had people from Iowa who were in different places that were, you know, supposed to be adding their votes into the circumstances.
Well, who runs an election using an app?
Well, that's the other thing.
Crazy.
Yes, I know. But, I mean, you'd almost think that they could make the excuse that the app was hacked or something, right? But it's far worse.
It's completely ridiculous.
Now, the whole thing is ridiculous. You mean to tell me in each one of those rooms you couldn't come up with, you know, where 100 people show up, fine, or 125 or 130 or whatever. It's not.
You know what the name of the company is that made the app?
No, tell me.
Shadow Incorporated.
Oh, perfect. You know.
You can't make this stuff up.
No, you can't. And I'm telling you, like, just looking at the circumstance, it was like, you know, there was this one piece of footage I saw. This woman's trying to add up the votes, right? And she's like, well, there's actually 35 people for this candidate and 20 people for this candidate. And she adds it up. And guess what? It didn't match the number of people she was supposed to have in the room voting. She had one more vote than she had people. And I'm going, yeah, there's a problem right here. And this is before they said, wait, there's a problem with actually getting the results. Although it was hilarious hearing Wolf Blitzer keep a guy on the line a couple seconds too long and an operator at the DNC hung up on him. That was pretty funny. Did you see that, too?
No, I saw a headline on it.
But, oh, my goodness. Well, no, I heard it happen live, and I was like, you're kidding me. That is hilarious. Wolf Blitzer keeps talking to him. He's got two phones in his hand. And the lady's like, hello, hello. And the guy's still talking to Wolf Blitzer. And then she hangs up on him after he's been waiting for like 90 minutes, which I found, you know, hilarious that the news guy actually disrupted this guy trying to report in his stuff by calling in. No, the whole thing is just, I mean, it was, you've heard of designed obsolescence. This was designed failure. You know, so
well, what are they trying to do? They're just going to ruin themselves.
Well, see, that's what I think overall. It doesn't matter anyway. But, you know, overall, even if you were like a totally objective, okay, I'm not going to pick a side person. And,
yeah.
You know, and you're like, okay, so I'm not going to bash Trump, but I'm not going to endorse him. And I'm not going to say the Democrats are useless, but I'm not going to say I'm with them. If you were looking at this objectively, you'd go, well, this guy, you know, as crazy as he is, he at least has his stuff together. These people, they can't even handle their own process among their own people. So why am I going to select these individuals to, you know, back, let's say, right? I mean, would you? I'd look at that and go, well, that's incompetence at best. You know, but at worst, I really do feel as though there's a hidden agenda here and they want to make sure to kneecap Sanders. And Trump, I think, even tweeted something to that effect where it was like, you know, here they go again, you know, being dishonest. And I actually think he's right. I think they did that to him in 2016. You know, we know that there's some suspicion about this, but I really think they did. I think they put a kibosh on Sanders in 2016 because Hillary was supposed to be the choice. And I think they're doing it again, and they're doing it badly because this is a bad strategy. But it is effective enough to allow Biden to float until they can, like, let some of the people that are going to run out of money run out of money. And obviously they're going to have to run to some choice to, you know, to back, because they don't want to back Trump. So anybody but Trump, they're going to go somewhere. And I think eventually he's just going to collect up the, you know, the ones who are left behind by all these other campaigns. And Buttigieg is not a viable choice. He's just not nationally. One third of this country, I guarantee you, equates a homosexual man with a pedophile. I'm telling you this bluntly. This is a mentality in a significant portion of this population. So there is an automatic offset on the possibility of even getting a vote for Pete Buttigieg based on that alone. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that that is what the reality is here. So, I mean, he's not going to be a viable candidate. And Biden is an awful candidate. And Klobuchar is an awful candidate. Whatever happened to Tulsi Gabbard, I don't know. Maybe she took a nap. Maybe she's still there. I know she was still on the list.
Oh, I just think she's doing what she's always doing.
No, she was still on the list, though, for the caucus people. Yeah. Nobody picked her. No, I mean, zero picked her. You know, it's like five people picked Biden in a room of 100. Nobody picked Tulsi Gabbard.
I think she's just an internet person.
Well, you know, she may indeed be a non-player character in the video game. I don't know, but anyway, not a viable choice. All I'm saying is they don't have a viable choice for the most part, and where they do have a viable choice, they have a guaranteed loser in the horse race. So, you know, what are you going to do? I don't know, except you got to understand that.
Well, it's not over yet. Yeah. We can hope. Okay. Something better happens in the next primary or two or something, or Super Tuesday. Something better can happen. Well, I don't know what that would be, but.
Yeah, me neither. I certainly don't want to hand
just a straight election, just something normal.
Wouldn't
that
be nice?
That's all we want. See, I mean, we were supposed to get, yeah. That's the whole promise of Biden, was he's going to make things normal. We stop the madness, and they're not stopping it. Can't they just have a normal election?
No. Just no. Don't you understand? We are no longer in Kansas, Michael. I should say Toto, but we're no longer in Kansas. Although Trump thought we were when it comes to the Kansas City Chiefs. Anyway.
I just want things back to normal again.
No, you don't, Mike. Maybe you do, but no, you don't, Mike. It's all right. Anyway, this hour is done. We're going to talk to JP Sottile next. Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. Of course, go over there, check out his stuff, check out his podcast, check out the things that he writes, no matter what they are. The War State, I recommend. And, you know, we're going to keep having these conversations, Mike, until the world does go back to normal. Then who knows? Maybe we won't have to talk anymore. We can do other things. But I'm not holding my breath. How about you?
Oh, you can hope it gets better.
You can hope, but you can always hope and beg for change and all that. But Obama's gone. Anyway, JP Sottile next. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect will be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
A reminder that this is the Voice of America broadcasting worldwide.
The end of transitions.
Warning, warning, warning.
Uncle, the podcast.
The Ocelli Effect.
Morgan's Policy Radio with Pierce Redman.
On Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
This is Maria Heller, producer and host of The Maria Heller Show. I've been podcasting since 2000. The Ocelli Show is one of the very few that I endorse. Chuck does a great job of telling you like it is and deserves your support. In these days of lies, fake news, and corporate media, it's more important than ever to support the few voices out there that are in it just like you are and aren't afraid to tell the truth. Feel good at the end of the day, knowing you've helped support a voice for we the people, and donate today. Also, don't miss our twice a month Hell and High Water that offers solutions and not just the problems. All for one and one for all.
What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite them? How do you make them feel as one with you?
I don't know how.
Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, the thing that is most of the essence is that you make this mob an extension of yourself. What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite them? How do you make them feel as one with you? Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, for their anger, is most of all the essence is that you make this mob an extension of yourself.
One, two, three, and we will get the rest.
What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite? How do you make them feel as one with you? Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. Talk to them of poverty. Talk to them of their fears. Give them objects for their anger. Make this mob an extension of yourself.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. Of course, I am so glad you are tuned in with us instead of watching the State of the Union, which I'm sure will be analyzed ad nauseum afterwards. But anyway, it is what it is. It is a Tuesday night, and I am extremely happy, although I don't know if I'm going to remain happy because I took a look at a couple articles that came out on Patreon today. From J.P. Satilli, the News Vandal himself, newsvandal.com. And, of course, you can go to Patreon and support J.P. Satilli. I will include that link with tonight's show, and I advise you to do so. Why? A couple articles came out, and they were relevant to what is on my mind and what I tried to save until this second hour, but Mike brought it up, so we went there. You know, two things. Iowa, impeachment, the State of the Union. Whatever it is, the alleged Amerigo states formerly united under Trump the Great. JP, how you doing, man?
I'm watching Ball. The golden. This is what I think. I think Trump is Ball, right? If you're not familiar with the Old Testament, Ball was the golden calf that. Yeah. That the Hebrews worshipped when they, pardon me, when they got out of the Egyptian captivity and they were falling away into these evil ways of the Canaanites, and he's kind of gold plated. He likes everything to be gold plated, and the apostates are worshiping him as a god.
Interesting bit of etymology, by the way, is that some people claim that Cannibal, the cannibal, is actually a priest of Baal who just happens to eat people. Anyways,
nice.
Just
nice.
Saying, go ahead.
Very good, very good. It's going to be very edifying here. I have to mention it. I am obsessed with this idea that Donald Trump is in the World Wrestling Entertainment Hall of Fame. And way back when he was running as a candidate, the Washington Times did a story on him, and they're the only one to do this story. And they went in depth on how Donald Trump pulled much of his persona from his apprenticeship under the tutelage of the McMahons. Mm-hmm. Now, Linda McMahon became head of the Small Business Administration, which – people didn't even blink an eye because everything was so nutty in the first, you know, the first 100 days of the Trump administration.
Yeah, the guy from Exxon was running the State Department, for God's sake.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Uh-huh. And which is amazing because it turns out that T. Rexon, as the great James Moore likes to call him, turned out to be one of the rational actors in the administration. And T. Rexon, by the way, the falling out with Trump was always probably in the cards, but was catalyzed by Trump's famous Randy speech before the National Boy Scout Jamboree in Virginia, where he talked about being on a friend's yacht and all of the racy chicks that were on the yacht and whatnot. And that was kind of the final straw, apparently, for T-Rex on.
What
so,
a weird thing to take objection to as an adult, just saying.
I mean, it's like, he was because he was an Eagle Scout.
I know, but like of all the offensive things,
Like, well, I didn't say, look, final straw. I thought it was outer space, man. It's just nuts. Anyway, so I'm fascinated by this because I really do think that if you look at his rallies, you've seen it. He sits down the tunnel and he gets poised. And when he walks out, he walks very slowly, much like a stone cold Steve Austin after winning the world title, wearing the belt, goading the crowd to adoration, walking slowly, sticking the chin out a la Mussolini, those kinds of things that are all, I think, standard fare for the conquering hero character of World Wrestling Entertainment, particularly in the past. It's probably changed a little bit now.
But yes, it has. But one thing you're leaving out of this imagery, which I need you to throw in, is the throngs of individuals dressed in the branded garb,
exactly,
chanting,
yeah,
USA, USA, which I recall was something that became very popular with a World Wrestling Federation character named Sergeant Slaughter, actually.
Yeah, there you go.
And why?
There you go.
Because he was, you know, facing down the foreigners, like the Iron Sheik. And,
like the Iron Sheik, the famous Iron Sheik. Yes. So when he came in tonight to the House to give the State of the Union speech, which is usually a boring and slightly solemn affair with, you know, the usual pat lines and the bromides, and then, you know, here's the people we invited, here's somebody who, you know, chewed off their leg after being trapped for 20 days in a foreign prison after they were trying to take out foreign terrorists or whatever it is.
That's right, Gorilla Monsoon, we've come to the Mecca.
Yeah, so tonight, watching him walk in, and then I guess we can leave this, because I could tell you, as I'm watching it right now on C-SPAN with the super titles on,
yes,
only the Republicans are cheering at him. The Democrats are just basically boycotting any applause whatsoever. That started really from him entering the House. And from what I'm reading and seeing, this is a campaign rally speech. That's him on script. So if you took a campaign rally speech but kept him on script so he doesn't go off script and start talking about how you're going to get cancer from windmills and all the other stuff, or have those weird little strokes where he says anonymous, that stuff. So,
or washing machines. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it talks about washing machines. This is basically a campaign rally, which makes perfect sense for him because that's really what he does best. I mean, that's his forte. But as he walked in incredibly slowly and took deliberative, purposeful steps. And then when he got to the dais and in front of the two teleprompters and the cheers were coming, he actually stepped away like he does at a rally and walked from side to side to soak up the adoration.
It's like Apollo Creed entering with James Brown behind him, except no good sound and no style. Yeah,
yeah,
okay,
no, he's
gotcha.
Got James White behind him, as in Mike Pence.
There you go. Thank you. Go ahead.
So, look, this is a fascinating punctuation mark. You mentioned the two things I've written, and I think we can talk about Iowa. I'd be happy to talk about Iowa. I'm happy to talk about the Democratic field. I just want to take, you know, because Trump is going to take a victory lap, I'm going to take a little bit of a victory lap here. Because mm-hmm. his victory lap is going to last all the way through to November. Mine will just be tonight for a few minutes. But I was engaged in a number of debates over the last year and a half over Trump's impending impeachment, whether he should be impeached, particularly after the Mueller report came out. There were the 10 instances of obstruction of justice. Why not impeach then? The Democrats didn't pull the trigger. Democratic base got really, really edgy and gave Nancy Pelosi agita, as any good Italian would get. Right. And she resisted because I think she knew the politics. She came out of 2018 when there was record turnout and they ran on health care primarily. It worked really, really well. And she knew, I think, the politics of impeachment were not favorable. And then there was this interregnum between the Mueller report and the first reports of the Ukraine shakedown deal. And in that interregnum, Trump was left to his own devices. He did not have Mueller to go at every day. He didn't have the, you know, Mueller and the 12 angry Democrats. He didn't have the witch hunt, the hoax, the Russia hoax. He didn't have any of that. And his approval rating started to decline because it was basically him on Twitter just spitting bile and making ridiculous statements and being purposefully mean and trying to troll people very badly and doing all those things that he does, but without a target, without some target for his vitriol and some way to attach his vitriol to a grievance and to a sense of persecution. And that's the currency that he has with his supporters.
Yeah, but beefing with Greta Thunberg didn't go very far, just saying. Yeah.
Right. So in that period between the two scandals, his numbers dropped to 38. There was a moment where he went over the course of like 3 or 4 weeks from 43 to 38. He was like in free fall. And then the impeachment thing started to gin up. Then once the Ukraine thing broke, people started to go, oh, now we got the impeachment. Now we got the impeachment, which plays into the narrative. The Democrats were an impeachment looking for a crime, basically, right? Mm-hmm. Looking for an excuse. And that started the long, slow climb of his approval ratings. Now, today, Gallup comes out. His approval ratings are at 14.9. 14.9. Not 44, 45. No, 49. That is an 11-point swing from the beginning of the impeachment drive when the Ukraine story broke to the eve of his acquittal. 11 points. Mm-hmm. Now, I have looked at this for years now, years. And I am convinced that Donald Trump just needs to be north of 46% approval rating to win in the Electoral College. That's what he needs. Mm-hmm. If he's north of 46, he's got a path, particularly given the fact that the Democratic candidate is going to be some kind of target-rich environment that they are going to be able to use to drive down turnout in key battleground states and key precincts in key cities in those key battleground states. Mm-hmm. So this impeachment drive – now, in my piece that I posted on newsmail.com, I point out people could say, yeah, it's the economy too. Okay, I'll give you a point or two on the economy, but I think the economy is BS. I think that people – they have a programmed reaction when they hear the stock market is up that they just assume that means the economy is good. But there were a couple reports. Brookings had a big – in-depth study on this, I believe. It came out a couple weeks ago. I featured it on the rundown, showing that the employment numbers are bogus because what we have in the United States is massive chronic underemployment because the gig economy is soaking up unemployed individuals and putting them in jobs where they are simply treading water. Because I guarantee you, I've taken a number of Uber rides, right? I ask every Uber driver, and I've never heard an Uber driver say that they're doing well.
Listen, don't limit it to Uber drivers. You know, there are people that work for DoorDash. There are people that work for Uber Eats. There are people I'm just saying, not just driving, but there's a huge gig economy.
No, that was just my anecdotal tie to the larger data set. We're in a massive gig economy right now where people who used to be unemployed are no longer unemployed. No longer unemployed. But they're not making money. So I think the economy thing is bogus. And by the way, the economy itself is bogus. Great first hour with the great Michael Swanson, by the way. If you didn't listen to it, go back to Ocelli.com and listen to it, particularly the stuff on Tesla, really fascinating stuff, and Chipotle and the sort of the terrible fundamentals of the economy. One thing that Michael Swanson didn't mention, not that he doesn't know it, I know he knows it backwards and forwards, it just didn't come up, is that the Fed is pumping free money into Wall Street through the repo loan market, the overnight lending market, where basically they're just providing money to Wall Street financial institutions, bankers and investors, every morning they've got a little sort of free money gift basically in their inbox that they can use to play with the market.
Well, he mentioned that the Fed was directly pumping money into Wall Street, but he
just
didn't describe
it. Okay, yeah. I guess I missed that.
No worries. So, believe me, he covers it.
He covers it. So there you go. So I guess he just didn't use the term repo market, so it went over my head. But anyway, which is better because whenever I say repo market, it sounds like I'm talking about cars. Right. So the economy, it's fine. I'll give you a point or two. Maybe, but this is about Donald Trump triumphant. This is about a guy who was given the ultimate gift. The American people, when they see a public figure who they feel is being targeted unfairly or excessively, they default to sympathy. Mm. Happens time and again. It's the lesson of the Clinton impeachment. And the Democrats did not heed the lessons of the past, and they've given this guy a clear path through to November with this impeachment.
Well,
49, by the way, 49, that's a landslide, folks. Yeah. 49 is knocking out a couple Democratic senators and maybe picking up the House.
Right. Now, here's the thing. Let me join you in your victory lap just a little bit, because guess what? I'm also correct here, because I said all along that strategically this was bad. It was not. There was no point to doing it. And in fact, I used the John Gotti template and said, here's what's going to happen. Now, not only have you given him that, so, you know, the sympathy vote you were talking about there, but you've also given him they tried to get me and they can't.
Yep. You get me.
Which, you know, turned John Gotti into a folk hero. Now, I'm certainly not comparing Donald Trump to John Gotti exactly, because I have respect for John Gotti, but.
Right, I was going to say, because he actually knew how to be a mafia don. He wasn't some Protestant nouveau riche. Anyway, okay, go ahead, continue.
No,
sorry.
And listen, the man did work on the street a bit. All right, I'm just saying he knew how to put in some work. All right, but the fact is that you have that element too, where you couldn't get me. So the anti-hero, they didn't get me because they're actually the corrupt ones and everything else. They fed into his narrative with this.
Into his WWE persona.
Yeah. I mean, you know, five guys attacked me. They tried to take me out with the steel chair, but I held on to the belt. You know, I'm just saying it works on a lot of different levels here. And I said that to begin with, is that they're guaranteeing him a victory by doing this. And I don't understand it. I mean, yes, do I agree that there is a reason to investigate this? Do I agree that according to the publicly known information alone, this guy is corrupt? But you know what's funny? Is that I thought they could have gone after him on a lot of different things here, and they didn't, which almost seems intentional to allow him to walk on, gee, are you profiting from your office? Is that something that's not easily demonstrable publicly? I think so, but pay no attention to that, right?
Well, why not just open an investigation and not call it impeachment and just hold hearings after hearings after hearings after hearings? You then start with this, and then you get into the Lev Parnas thing. And by the way, Lev Parnas, I actually believe, was set up when he was arrested, because I think that Bill Barr and Giuliani were trying to scare him into not cooperating with the Democrats.
Right, but why not?
If you look at his charges, his charges do not actually tie to some of the things he's linked to Giuliani on. They were on other charges not linked to Giuliani, and that's an intentional decision to not prosecute him on crimes that are linked to Giuliani, and I think that kind of lets that cat out of the bag. Why not just do it all summer? Just keep going.
Well, how about this, JP? You know, the House Select Committee on Presidential Corruption. You know, they could have assembled this and continued an investigation. It's not like they haven't done this before. For special circumstances, it can be done. Why wasn't that done? Nobody asks that question, by the way. All these political talking heads, even Rick Wilson, who I'm starting to like, by the way, a lot.
Rick Wilson is The thing about Rick Wilson is that he's entertaining.
Yes.
And one of the things about Rick Wilson, if you're not familiar with Rick Wilson, I think his book is Everything That Donald Trump Touches Dies.
That's one
and
of them, yeah.
I think that's the name of it, right?
That's one of
them.
And
Rick
them, yeah.
Wilson, he was a sort of brass knuckle GOP operative for many, many years in the mold of Lee Atwater and kind of Roger Ailes, sort of a mashup of Lee Atwater and Roger Ailes. Very media savvy, very tough, very kind of a rat, you know what, on some level. Mm-hmm. Not to the extent of Roger Stone. I didn't mention Roger Stone because it was always within the bounds of campaigning, whereas Roger Stone was not a campaign guy. He was a true rat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, copulator.
Right.
So Wilson didn't do the rat copulation, but he would be the kind of guy that would come up with the Willie Horton ad, which is take your opponent, find their culture war, social issue weakness, and hammer it and hammer it and hammer it with incredibly negative ads. So he knows how to beat Democrats really, really well. But he is one of these never Trumpers who, you know, sort of like Joe Walsh and some of these guys who decided I can't do this.
Right.
So it was a bridge too far, and has actually turned a lot of that energy back on Trump and the Lincoln Project, which he is a part of, which is a sort of a super PAC advocacy group of never Trumpers who used to be Republican political operatives. They're running incredibly effective ads. They've run some incredibly effective ads against Cory Gardner, for example, who is a on-the-bubble Republican senator from Colorado who has voted against witnesses and will vote to acquit and is in a state, Colorado, that has been trending down. Colorado's governor is an openly gay man,
mm-hmm.
Jared Polis. So Colorado there was a time when Colorado was at the forefront of sort of Reagan Republicanism, sagebrush, you know, pseudo crypto libertarian Republicanism, and particularly because it has Colorado Springs and the Air Force Academy, which itself had been one of the epicenters of evangelical influence in America for some time. Mm-hmm. That I think has changed a little bit because there are a couple sex scandals that happened there, and then one religious freedom scandal that happened there during the time that sort of our General Boykin, you know, freak out in post 9/11. Now, if you're not familiar with General Boykin, he's the guy that said, we'll kill the Muslims because our God's a bigger God than theirs. And he was, you know, very sort of crypto Christian fascist kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
So Rick Wilson, just a quick, you know, a thumbnail sketch of what he's all about.
Right.
You were saying?
No, I was just saying I happen to like him at this point because he is just on the money about certain things. I don't agree with his political beliefs. I don't necessarily agree with, but his analytical skills are immense, and he's also rather entertaining, rather cutting, and in various settings. You know, again, even on network shows where, you know, language is not a limitation, the guy has no problem with that. You know what I'm saying?
You mean Maher's show. He was good on Maher's show.
Yeah, he was good there. You know, but he's also good showing up on any of these channels where it's like, well, here's what it is. The Democrats want to win. They got to stop doing this nonsense. And it sounds like what I'm thinking. You know, and I'm like, wow, this guy's got it. And he's even saying, you know, at this point, I want to help you, Democrats, because I'd like to see anybody in there but this guy, you know, and reclaim the GOP. And I'm like, well, I can't blame you there. So, you know, I kind of have a bit of respect for some of what's coming out of his mouth, to be honest with you.
Well, I think that this is the conundrum that many Americans face right now. Anybody who's not in the movement, anybody who's not getting served the Kool-Aid or whatever you want to say, however you want to frame it. Because mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you, I think at this point, if you are supporting Donald Trump, you are taking on some of the responsibility for his actions and his personality and who he is.
Yep.
It's there. You cannot. There's no way to square yourself with that and say you are aiding and abetting. You are losing some of your ethical and moral luster, in my opinion. It's too blatant. So, but that's put that aside. Trying to extricate him from the White House is the challenge. And so this brings us back to where we were. Mm. Impeachment has made extricating him from the White House infinitely more difficult.
Right.
Now that he's sitting at 49%, it's starting to look not just like you're going to have a hard time defeating him. It looks like you may actually lose more of the Senate. And then forget about the House. The House is in trouble if you do that. And what you're looking at, another Supreme Court justice, more appellate court justices that he pulls out of law school that have no degree and no experience in jurisprudence, but toe the party line, are part of some right-wing Christian ideology, evangelicals. I mean, the stakes are incredibly high, but the Democrats are incredibly inept. I mean, staggeringly inept, which brings us to Iowa, right? And so I heard you in the first hour. People didn't listen the first hour. Iowa came up at the end because you almost just – there's a point at which you can't contain yourself because it's such a
– It's so bad.
It's so bad. I mean, it is really bad. Oh. Now, there are two ways to look at this. One is that this is just par for the course Democratic incompetence. And so the deal is that the company that made the reporting app is called Shadow, and it's owned by another company called Acronym. The idea was
– Wait.
Yes. No, I'm not kidding.
I want people to wrap their minds around that, that the name of the company who made this app that apparently, you know, took a dump in the bed, all right, over there, for this, you know, caucus situation in Iowa is named Shadow. Is
Shadow
that right?
Inc. Yes, and it's owned by another company called Acronym.
Acronym. Okay.
Acronym. And Acronym is run by Tara McGowan, and Tara McGowan, somebody tracked it down when Mayor Pete Buttigieg announced his exploratory committee, seemed to post a celebratory tweet. Mm-hmm. Mayor Pete Buttigieg had actually hired Shadow to do some computer coding, you know, interactive app stuff for him, for his campaign. So now people are starting to go, ah, well, there's your thing. Already, I like to watch how progressives deal with one another. Because if Democrats could attack Republicans half as well as they attack one another, they might actually get somewhere. They might get into Rick Wilson's league, right? They're not anywhere near that. And so I've seen this many times. You know, he's called Mayo Pete by progressives, and the progressives really despise him. His time at McKinsey, which is a global consulting firm, mm-hmm. which is involved in all kinds of nefarious corporate blah. It's not a pretty picture. And then, you know, he went to Afghanistan, which on the surface would seem good because he's a veteran. But I think on the progressive side, there's also some sort of disquiet at people who are not critical of their war service or the wars that they served in, the way Tulsi Gabbard is. That's how you inoculate yourself on the left, right? So, I mean, that's actually how John Kerry made his name in the 70s, was being a war hero who was critical of the war he was involved in. And then, of course, he got swift voted. It didn't help that when he went to the convention, he said, John Kerry reporting for service, and gave a salute sign. Anyway, that's 2004. One of the blunder, a political blunder. Mm-hmm. So, where was I going? So, I've seen many times that, you know, people half jokingly say that they believe that Mayor Pete is actually a CIA agent, that he's CIA, right? So this kind of feeds into that whole narrative, because one of the people who works for Tara McGowan at Acronym is actually married to one of Pete Buttigieg's advisors. Okay.
So this is all very funny, JP, but I need to dispense with what it is you're saying here with the ultimate death blow to his entire candidacy, which I'm not saying I agree with this, but let's face facts and get to brass tacks, okay? There is one third of this country solidly that is not going to accept an openly gay president.
I know. Still. I hear you on that, but I actually – I part a company with you a little bit. I think a gay male veteran who is a professed Christian is probably more likely to become president than a woman.
Okay, well, you and I will have to agree to disagree there because, you know, that one-third I'm talking about doesn't just believe that this is a bad idea or is uncomfortable with it. You know, despite all the progress that's
been made. I know,
but
that one-third is already a sunk cost in the election.
I understand, but what I'm saying is when you – I know what you're getting at, but I think in general, even in Democratic circles where there is a public face of progressivism and they're very, 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 very concerned with making sure that they diversify things until they get to a debate stage and everybody's white, you know – I don't think that that's altogether honest all across the board. So I don't see that there is – I think there is a hidden backlash to this guy that nobody is going to say
agree.
Publicly.
No, I see – I agree with you. There is a challenger. I also think, conversely, that there are people who would like to virtue signal by saying that they voted for Pete Buttigieg. Look, nothing has – Chuck, we've lived parallel lives as in terms of our age, the decades we've been through. I've never seen anything change like the attitudes towards LGB. I'm not going to go to TQ because those attitudes haven't changed. But particularly LG and maybe B, the attitude as it was tied to the issue of same-sex marriage – the shift on that from 2004 when Karl Rove was able to help turn that election for George Bush in no small part because he strategically peppered anti-gay marriage initiatives on ballots, ballot initiatives in states and swing states to try and drive up evangelical and Christian turnout.
No, in a 25-year frame, you and I cannot bear witness to anything as a more radical change in social norms and acceptability and tolerance than what we witnessed regarding this. Because, again, if you rewind 25 years, just 25 years from today, you know, that was those people. That was
– I'm going to say 15 years.
Well, even so, but 25 for sure – there was still, you know, those are the people still with, you know, the AIDS problem. Those are the people still who don't really belong in society. We need to debate whether they need to be in jobs where they're around people that are vulnerable of any walk of life.
Well, I'll give you a little fun fact. First openly gay returning character in television was on Barney Miller.
Mm. Okay.
And that was a big deal. And Noam Pitlick and Danny, what's his name? The creator, the two guys that created it, Danny, I can't remember his last name. They took heat and they stuck by their guns to introduce this character. It was a big deal. Then came Jack Tripper, right, on Three's Company, who they got away with kind of ridiculous, gay stereotypes being repeated through a semi-gay character who is not really gay, and that's how they got away with it, right? I mean, it took
right.
– and then came Billy Crystal as a gay character on Soap circa 1979. I mean, these were like blips. These were very rare. And
my favorite introduction to a gay character was in you know, one of the places you'd expect it, which is on All in the Family. Where Archie Bunker suddenly finds out one of his friends is gay.
Yeah,
I don't know if you remember
that's
that.
A one-off. That's not a repeat character.
It's a one-off, but it's pretty interesting for its time period.
Well, let's just say it right now. Norman Lear one of the great creative minds of the 20th century.
Right.
I mean, come on, Norman Lear. So where are we going with – let's get back to brass tacks here. So I think that Buttigieg, as much as there is this – I actually think the age is almost more of an issue than the sexuality, I'll be honest with you. So – and the fact that he's coming from being a mayor, I think that the age and experience actually works – is a little bit more of a challenge than even the homosexuality, because the people who are going to vote against him on homosexuality are going to vote against any of the Democratic candidates, except for maybe a small portion of them might go for a Biden if Biden were to ever get the nomination, which I don't think he's going to get the nomination. So, let's keep going. So back to where we were talking about Buttigieg and acronym and. Shadow. Okay, so a little detour there.
I'm sorry.
We even got into television history. You know, we can do that, Chuck. That's
exactly
what we do. So the question is whether there's something nefarious here, right, to try and steal the thunder away from Bernie Sanders, which, by the way, last I checked on the results before we came on the air with, 70% reporting? Buttigieg is leading in delegates. There's kind of a flaw there a little bit insofar as Buttigieg got some of his thunder taken away from him, because if the rally had come in on time, both he and Bernie would have basically been neck and neck, much like Hillary and Bernie were in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them could have declared victory. And I watched Buttigieg's speech last night, and it was a victory speech. It was probably one of the better speeches he's given during the campaign.
True.
So he lost a little bit there too. So it wasn't like it was a clean win for him that this Shadow Inc. app tanked the Democratic Party's efforts in Iowa. Also, by the way, one of the little punchlines of this whole thing is that Shadow Inc. was actually hired by the Democratic Party, to help them stem the tide of losses to the Trump online social media technology campaign.
Right.
That this was actually these guys were going to be the solution to the fact that Brad Parscale, by integrating Cambridge Analytica micro-targeting psychological warfare techniques, is running circles around the Democrats who, as we might recall, back in 2008 and 2012, the conventional wisdom was that the Obama team had taken the use of online social media apps, right, technology, and far and away blown the Republicans out of the water and had a massive technological advantage that was going to carry them forever. No. And so here we are watching the company that basically derailed the Iowa caucuses also being the company that was held the promise of resurrecting the Democrats' technological voter outreach efforts.
Mm.
So that you, when I put those together, I don't see the outlines of a conspiracy. I see the dark shadow of utter and complete incompetence.
See, I think that is what you're meant to see.
Okay. Well, and, I mean, look.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
Here's ultimately what this did. I don't believe Buttigieg will survive the process here in the primaries. I don't believe it. I tell you that I stand by my reasoning from earlier and a couple other things. He was not able to handle a situation in South Bend regarding, nice, you know, a problem with the police and people of color.
No, he has a serious issue with black voters, and
right,
South Carolina is – that's like the graveyard, right?
Yeah, because exactly.
South Carolina is the first primary that actually reflects the Democratic electorate in some sense, in a significant sense. That's, I think, 25% of the electorate there is African American, which is that's the primary Democratic, one of the primary Democratic constituencies you have to have, and that's you right. don't find that in Iowa and New Hampshire. So.
No, see that's the thing. In addition, I see this as a way to kneecap Bernie Sanders without leaving a paper trail. And I'll tell you why, because I was watching some of that stuff in progress. I didn't see the big rally for Biden. I didn't see the big rally for Buttigieg, although he existed, right? I saw Klobuchar, which I couldn't understand, existing. I still don't understand why she's in the campaign, but there she is.
Well, I can go through that. So Klobuchar, her selling point is that she's Midwestern mm-hmm. in a state that, oh, by the way, if Trump is at 49, he's going to flip Minnesota Republican for mm-hmm. the first time since Reagan, I think.
Yeah, that's been a while.
Or maybe not even Reagan, because Mondale won his home state of Minnesota. In 84, it's the only state he won. So,
right. That's, right. So I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking Minnesota. They is in play, folks. Don't sleep on that.
Right.
So that's her pitch, is that she's got the woman thing going. So that's check that off. She's a former prosecutor. She's a so she has the tough on crime thing. That's her problem. By the way, I think one of the things that has slowed down what little momentum she was starting to get in Iowa is this thing about this African-American teenager who she put in jail, and it looks like a railroad job now.
Yeah,
so,
well, it's almost as good as Kamala Harris waving at, you know, parents that were getting thrown in jail for not having
right.
their kids go to school. Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's right. So there's that. And then maybe because she, you know, there were stories in Veep that were based on her eccentricities, like having an aide dry shave her legs under a desk once. But anyway, I digress. So that's the moderate lane. See, I think what you have here, you got your kneecap Bernie Sanders thing. The question that the Democrats have in their field is, who is the moderate alternative to a political revolution?
Mm-hmm.
Right? The political revolution scares people. And I think that it's pretty obvious, and it's been stated repeatedly that the Democratic establishment does not think that the target-rich environment of Bernie Sanders is going to survive a campaign against Donald Trump.
See, that is a difficult thing, and that's why I think that the DNC has pre-selected Biden. I still think that he's going to be there, and by attrition, some of these other candidates are going to fall off, because that's another thing about this Iowa delay where, you know, a lot of fundraising would have been done going into New Hampshire, given that there were results 24 hours earlier. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true.
No, actually, that's crucial, because what you do is Buttigieg and Bernie, had the results come in, both of them last night would have given a victory speech and immediately turned around and used their showing there to fundraise.
Right.
Also, probably Warren could have done a little fundraising, right, mm-hmm. a little bit. But if you take – I I don't know what the numbers are right now, but here's roughly what I saw, is that if you took Klobuchar and – Biden, who was at around 8%, and Klobuchar was at like 11, and Biden 8, and Buttigieg 27, so that was 17 and 27, 37. That was like – it was somewhere between 44 and 48 were moderate votes, mm-hmm. and then the rest, 49 to 51, was the progressive vote. Mm-hmm. So there's like a – the split that was there when it was Hillary versus Bernie is still there. It's just that the panoply of candidates, the array of candidates, has split those two factions into sub-factions.
Right, where even Yang is still holding on to, like, you know, 1 or 2%.
Yeah.
But now
Yang and Gabbard are probably going to do better in New Hampshire, because New Hampshire is actually a better place for them to – because if there's that – more libertarian, live free or die thing that goes on there. And those are easier place. It's an easier place to campaign when you don't have a lot of resources. You need a buttload of resources to get precinct captains and to do all of the organization. You have to have a huge organization. You have to go visit all of the counties, and you've got to have a get out the vote machinery to win the caucuses in Iowa.
Which Buttigieg worked at very, very hard. Steyer has resources, but guess what? Ended up with 0.03 or 0.02%.
Yeah, no, I think Steyer is banking on South Carolina.
Maybe.
So this is the new deal with elections. From what I've seen over the last 15 years, 20 years, 20 years, really after Gore, starting in 2004, so that's 15 years, is that candidates are starting to – you have the main like flagship candidates that have a huge load of money. And if they've got a huge load of money, they're going to contest the first three. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a huge load of money, there are candidates who decide on one of the first three and put their energy there and then hope that that builds momentum going into Super Tuesday.
Right.
And so – that's what I think you're seeing. Like Steyer, I think, is focusing on South Carolina for that reason. I think you got Tulsi Gabbard sat out Iowa, didn't show up, decided to go all in on New Hampshire. And I've actually watched her her events in New Hampshire, a lot of small events with 20, 30, 10, 15 people, house parties. And it was and it's been really interesting to watch. I don't know how many times on the C-SPAN, put you in the room events I've seen where people who voted for Trump are coming up to Tulsi Gabbard and saying, I'm for you. So that's she's trying to work that angle in New Hampshire, which I think is smart based on where she is. Oh, my God. By the way, time out. I am watching Melania Trump put the Presidential Medal of Freedom on Rush Limbaugh.
Really?
That's happening in real time right now, folks.
I was going to cap off our discussion with Limbaugh. You know that? Really?
Okay, so there you have it, okay?
Did she use the right hand this time? Because, you know, last time I saw her on video, she had her wrong hand over her own heart. So, you know, just saying.
Okay. So, but back to the election. There are a couple of the candidates. Biden, the one thing that Biden struggles with is running political campaigns for president. He has not done well.
Yeah.
He does not have a track record. And I think, we will know. Here's the thing, Chuck. Next time we get on the air, which is two weeks from tonight,
right,
we're going to know. Because I think Biden does have a shot at South Carolina at saving himself. If he doesn't do well in New Hampshire, I think there's a chance he will not do well in New Hampshire.
Right.
And I think that one thing that Buttigieg has, and it's a very typical Democratic presidential politics thing, he's new, fresh, and young.
Mm.
New, fresh, young, and smart, and can talk. Great speaker. He's a great speaker, right? So those candidates tend to do well in Democratic presidential politics.
In which case, don't count out Bernie, because no matter what you say, he'll turn it into the same answer.
I think Bernie – here's the thing. So in my other piece I wrote, the irony of this snafu that we were talking about in Iowa is that in a sense, it kind of – the upshot of it is that the Democrats actually cannot afford for Bernie to not be the nominee now. Because they cannot win if Bernie's people don't show up. Can't do it. There is no path to victory if Bernie supporters feel that they got shafted again and they will not vote for what I posted this on my stuff on Facebook. Bernie supporter said, I will never in a million years vote for a corporate Dem. That guy is not alone.
Right.
Not alone. There's a matrix of reasons why Hillary Clinton didn't win. One reason why is because there were people who thought that Bernie got shafted and they would never vote for a corporate Dem like her. They will never vote for Mike Bloomberg.
Yeah.
For example, Bernie people will never vote for Mike Bloomberg. So I think you can't win without their enthusiasm, without their get out the vote infrastructure that Bernie Sanders has built over the course of 5 years. And without the youth vote, because the Democrats need young people to show up. The Obama coalition was a reasonable spike, a kind of some people say unprecedented spike in young voter turnout, with a massive turnout of African American votes and suburban women and educated whites. That was the coalition, right? Mm-hmm. And also he did pull a lot of working class union folks in the Midwest.
Right.
So that was the Obama coalition. You are not going to win without those Bernie voters. Conversely, the Trump machine wants Bernie. Mm-hmm. They are poised and set up. As a matter of fact, I just posted a story from North Carolina where the Republican Party there is trying to convince Republicans to go I think it's South Carolina. They're trying to convince Republicans to go out and vote for Bernie so that Bernie will win the nomination. Mm-hmm. So Republicans voting for Bernie. And you know who pioneered that tactic? Rush Limbaugh.
That's right.
Okay. So the irony is that the Democrats, by having this snafu in Iowa, have basically made it that if this leads to Bernie not – because they, as you say, kneecapped Bernie, and Bernie doesn't get the nomination, they're dead.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if they get Bernie gets the nomination, they're probably dead.
Yeah. Yeah, which leads to exactly what I've been saying all along, JP. I'm sorry, but guess what? Trump wins in November.
I think right now if you had to have me put money down, I would bet on re-election.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a guarantee at this point, despite the fact that he probably has done some criminal things, despite the fact that he has done some criminal things,
despite
the fact that he's urinated on the Constitution, despite the fact that he can't, you know, I don't know, something is wrong with him. You know, I'm not the guy saying that he's on drugs, because I don't think he would do drugs, but something's wrong with him.
Oh, no, I fully think that he is an amphetamine user. And there's the picture from the Taco Bowl picture. Remember the Taco Bowl picture?
Yeah, but I'm not sure if we're looking at drug use sort of riddling the brain with holes or if it's later stage syphilis. I mean, really, seriously.
Well, it's something. But I do think that he's probably an Adderall addict.
You know, you and a lot of people say that. And that might be why he's sniffling so much.
I think that's probably... I mean, it's, you know, so I want to make one more point about impeachment, because you talked about defecating on the Constitution, or I think you said urinating.
Yeah.
I think defecating is a better comedy word, personally.
Could be. Okay.
I like to bring back the term defecate. So anyway.
No problem.
I think it's because it's one of the great lines from the Judge's song in Pink Floyd, The Wall. Anyway. So one of the other upshots of impeachment, because one of the arguments for impeachment was, well, look at what he's doing. You can't let him get away with this and not do or say something. But the funny thing is that by bringing these charges and then having it fait accompli, having him acquitted in the Senate, they've actually gotten Congress to put their imprimatur on his unconstitutional actions. Mm. So in a sense, they unintentionally established a precedent in Congress for executive power.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely.
So they got schooled on two levels with the impeachment. Yep. Not only was it the biggest political blunder of my lifetime, and I put it – what are the great political blunders of our lifetimes, Chuck? Susan Estridge put Dukakis in the tank with the helmet.
There you go. One.
Big political blunder.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another one. Al Gore walks away from a popular sitting president in Bill Clinton and will not have him campaign for him going into his election with George W. Bush.
Yeah, he doesn't have him stumping for him in 2000. Yeah,
when Bill Clinton is at the height of his powers.
Right.
When you send him to Florida over and over and over again, to southern Florida and to Tallahassee and to Orlando, you mm-hmm. don't do that. Big political blunder.
Mm-hmm.
Then Hillary Clinton doesn't go to Wisconsin, right? Among other things, right?
Among other things, yes.
Among other things, political blunder. But I think this is right there. I mean, this is
– Can't fight this with is, here. It is just as bad. You know, JP, we're out of time, and we're going to have to continue this discussion kind of in 2 weeks and see exactly how all this pans out. But at the end of the day, I think, Trump wins in November, and that's about that. And, I guess we'll see who the next victim is from the DNC pile. But in the meantime, go over to newsvandal.com, get the rundown, check out JP's latest articles on Patreon. Of course, Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com was with us in the first hour. Both hours I'm extremely proud of already. Hopefully you learned something along the way as well. JP, thanks so much for doing this with me.
Ciao, Paisan.
Anyway, guys, I am Emilio Celli. All of you are indeed the effect. Have a good night.